Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the author of a new book shares his experiences living with autism and says we need to change the conversation. Meet the author of the new book, We're Not Broken. First, over most of the country, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is recommending everyone wear masks indoors, regardless of vaccination status. That's a reversal from the guidance it offered 2 months ago. Back then, it seemed as if the worst of the pandemic might be behind us. Since then, cases of COVID-19 have surged where vaccination rates were low, and the highly contagious Delta variant is showing up all over the place, including some cases in fully vaccinated people. Here in Wisconsin, health officials in Milwaukee say the numbers are going in the wrong direction. Mayor Tom Barrett recently said while he's focused on getting people vaccinated, he's asking them to put their masks back on when indoors or among crowds.
This is a tough request to make because we felt like we're getting life back to normal. And we really don't want to use the enforcement because we're not sure that it's going to be effective right now.
He also said another mask mandate might be necessary if the situation doesn't improve. Our next guest says officials need to think carefully and set clear benchmarks before they issue new mask requirements. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How does the idea of some kind of mask mandate in your community sit with you? Do you feel like was not having to wear a mask one of the reasons you got the shot? Or are you okay with wearing masks indoors? What do you think needs to be considered before officials issue mask mandates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. She co-wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times about what she calls a smarter approach to mask mandates. Dr. Nuzzo, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to what you'd like to see us think about before imposing new mask mandates, what are you seeing out there right now? How are you seeing them being used as we deal with Delta?
Well, we're increasingly seeing them, and, you know, this is reflecting the fact that basically almost every state is seeing a resurgence of cases that's worse in the states with lower vaccination than the states that have higher vaccination. But nonetheless, we are seeing a rise in cases across the country. And, you know, this is prompting concerns that we're headed in the wrong direction and having health officials look at what we can do to, you know, bring the case numbers back to in the direction we'd like to see them, particularly as we're entering the school year. I think that's one of the big concerns is how can we make sure we can ensure that our kids can get back into the classroom and keep them there.
I don't think anybody super wants to mandate masks indoors at the local or state level. What are the thresholds you are looking at where you'd say, yeah, it's time to go with this measure, even if we're not that happy about it?
Well, it's not really a threshold in terms of absolute numbers. I mean, certainly when you have rapidly accelerating case numbers and you don't really know what's driving it, you usually don't have a choice but to implement the blunt tools that we had to use earlier in the pandemic, things like universal mask requirements indoors and things like that. That said, we are in different circumstances, and for places that aren't in an absolute crisis that do have a little bit of time, I think it's really important for them to try to understand what environments are driving their transmission and then to come up with measures that are targeted at those environments. And a good example of it, thinking about locally in Washington, D.C., some health clubs were complaining that the district had returned to an indoor mask mandate, and people have to, when they go to the gym, now have to wear a mask while they're working out, which is obviously not a very fun thing to have to do. But nonetheless, people who can go to bars and restaurants, and while they're eating and drinking and literally standing inches away from each other, they're not going to be wearing a mask. And so the question is, does making people wear a mask in a gym where there may be other tools that could be used, like perhaps increasing the distancing, improving the ventilation, et cetera, does that make sense? Or should we be thinking about restrictions in the places, say, if it's restaurants, we don't know. It certainly was earlier in the pandemic. Would restrictions targeted at those environments have more of an effect?
We heard from Mayor Barrett of Milwaukee there. And as I said in the setup, his priority is still trying to encourage vaccination. Masks, not the top priority, but just another tool in the toolkit. What do you think of that priority? Vaccinations being the main thing we're trying to encourage right now.
Absolutely. Vaccinations trump all. And even if you're hearing about a potential return to masks for everyone, regardless of vaccination status, really the concern is about the unvaccinated. And the fact that the unvaccinated are the ones that continue to need to wear masks. Unfortunately, in public spaces, it's difficult to tell who's vaccinated and who's not. And that's why you are starting to see a return to mask requirements for all. But it's not about protecting the vaccinated. It's about protecting those who aren't. So I absolutely support health officials' efforts to try to get as many people as possible vaccinated. If you qualify, please don't wait. Please get vaccinated. Now is the time. It not only helps you, but it helps the rest of your community and hopefully prevents us from having to go back to those state of restrictions that none of us like or want.
Talking to Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, epidemiologist there, talking about the idea of mask mandates when they might be appropriate, when they aren't the most useful tool. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Nuzzo, somebody might hear this and think, okay, your numbers are going up. Why not just err on the side of caution? Better safe than sorry, wide-ranging mask mandates for everybody. What's the problem with that?
Oh, absolutely. If you're that person, please do wear a mask. There's no harm, and if you enjoy wearing it. The worry that I have is more for people who have been on the fence about getting a vaccine, and now they hear that everybody's got to wear a mask regardless. I will tell you, as someone who spends a lot of time talking to people who are on the fence or not yet convinced about getting a vaccine, the prospect of everybody having to wear a mask has sent a bit of a, it's caused a bit of a dampening in potential enthusiasm. I want to underscore that the need to get vaccinated remains, and that people who are unvaccinated are far more at risk of contracting an infection and winding up in the hospital and dying from this virus than anybody who's vaccinated, masks use or otherwise. Again, you know, at this stage of the pandemic, we hope that we have better data to have more targeted approaches to controlling the spread of the virus so that we don't eliminate incentives for people to get vaccinated.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jesse is with us in Appleton. Jesse, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I feel that this is such an important topic that you have here. Unfortunately, I mean, I'm not against the vaccination, but I was born with bad lungs and I have a lot of breathing problems. And I'm not that out of shape, but it's just always been with me. And I'm terrified to get this disease or this virus. And I just don't understand why people... it is uncomfortable. It's awful. It sucks. It's hot, you know, but if it's for the better of the everybody in the country and this gets under control, I don't know why I'm embarrassed that my fellow Americans are just being like spoiled babies.
Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. Jennifer, Jesse, worried about people with like herself, maybe with a condition that might make her more vulnerable to COVID, saying, hey, maybe that should get the masks back on a little faster.
Yeah, and that's exactly one of the concerns. And that's why I think we're seeing a lot of jurisdictions, because, you know, while the people who are vaccinated are largely protected, we do worry about people who have underlying health conditions who may need additional protection beyond what the vaccine offers. And that's probably one of the reasons why the FDA is, you know, now potentially recommending boosters for people who are immunocompromised and have underlying health conditions. But, you know, masks best when you know they're worn, and they're worn by the people who need to wear them. And you know, we aren't yet in many places at a point of having a high enough level of vaccination where we can stop worrying about the unvaccinated not complying with masking. And I think that's why you're seeing places respond to these kind of reverse to these sort of blunter tools. That said, I, you know, continue to worry about people who may be exposed in environments where compliance with masks may not be high. Before I referenced restaurants and bars, I also worry about people, you know, gathering in social settings in people's homes where, you know, people are not likely to wear masks. And so I think we just need to have a bit of a more nuanced understanding of where people are getting sick. Other countries collect these data and they make them available. And I think there's no reason why we couldn't do that. We have them, these data in some instances, and they're not made public. I think it would help boost people's confidence about the public health recommendations that are being made so that people can make decisions for themselves by seeing the data for themselves.
Jesse, thanks for that call. We're talking about mask mandates and what officials should take into consideration when they're trying to figure out if they need to issue new orders. Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo is with us, epidemiologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of mask requirements being issued at a city or state level? How about in schools? How about at a workplace for employees and customers? Do you have your own mask mandate in place for yourself personally? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about mask mandates, when they make sense, when they don't. Our guest co-wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times saying we need to think carefully before issuing new orders, use them strategically. Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and or questions on the topic. Let's go back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Menominee. Nancy, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Nancy?
Well, a couple of things. One is that, of course, I'd like you to remind everybody that Governor Evers has been ordered by the Supreme Court not to issue any more mask mandates unless he has the legislator's approval. I'm sure you're aware of that. And then I'd like to ask the doctor to her opinion about this Alberta, Canada situation where the gentleman was fined for not wearing social distancing, and he took the city to court, and the health officer for Alberta, Canada was not able to provide any material evidence that the virus has been isolated. I guess it went all the way up to the Queen's Court, which I don't really know what that means. But if they can't isolate the virus, how can they talk about variants, and how could they even make a vaccine?
Nancy, thanks for the call. I'm not familiar with that case, but the virus has been isolated and genetically mapped. You know what the virus is, right, Dr. Nuzzo?
Yes, for sure. I'm not quite sure what that case is either. But, you know, I think the larger question is points to one of compliance. So there's mask mandates, and, you know, you could say everyone needs to wear a mask, and then there's do people actually do it. It was really interesting. One of the first places that implemented a mask mandate was Los Angeles, in part because they had one of the sort of earlier sort of resurgence of cases. And law enforcement there basically said that they weren't going to enforce the mask mandate. They didn't think it was, a good use of their time. And I think there were some kind of political disagreements about the value of it. But it speaks to the fact, and this is, again, why we need data. You could put a mandate out, but if people choose not to follow it, then you have a choice. You could either arrest people or, you know, give them a fine or whatever, or you could give them data that shows them why you think it's in their best interest.
Before I go back to our callers, Dr. Nuzzo, I want to get your thoughts on a large portion of our population that is unvaccinated because they can't be vaccinated yet, and they're about to gather together in the same place, school kids age 12 and under, not currently eligible to get vaccines. What do you think about masks in those situations, in those schools for kids 12 and under?
Well, I think about that topic a lot because I have two children that fall into that category who I am very hopeful will be able to return to school 5 days a week. You know, I think a number of parents are worried about, you know, their children having to wear masks. I know my children, having been outside for most of the summer and having had breaks from masks in the outside environments, are not really thrilled with the thought of going back to school and wearing them. But, you know, I think there are a number of operational advantages to keeping masks in place for the time being. The one being that above all, we have to get kids back into school and to keep them there. And if masks allow us to do that, to make teachers and other parents feel comfortable, particularly for, you know, the more vulnerable kids that also have to go to school, I think there's some advantages there. And then also, if there are exposure events in the classroom, having people have masks adds a layer of protection. That said, I have been critical of CDC guidance on masking in the classrooms because it doesn't specify when we get to stop. And I think that that's really important because not everybody is enthusiastic about their kids wearing masks. Kids aren't enthusiastic about wearing masks. We need to understand the conditions in which we are going to say it's okay. Are we waiting for a pediatric vaccine for kids under 12? Is that the end point? We don't know if we're going to have one. I'm very hopeful that we will, but we don't know. Are there certain levels of transmission that are low enough such that we think the odds of the virus coming to school are so small that we don't need them? I think it's really important for us to define off ramps. Otherwise, people will feel like this is never ending, and why bother anyway?
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Johnny is with us in Sparta. Johnny, hello.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Johnny?
I think that mask mandates are necessary right now. They are necessary because this virus has mutated. The alpha variant, it didn't affect kids as much and younger people. But the more this virus mutates and have kids, it needs a host to spread. And when you have all these people unmasked, you don't know what their vaccination status is. And to have that going inside of a classroom, these kids are coming from different homes where parents have different beliefs. And if there aren't masks in there, that's going to have the kids to take it back to their homes. And this thing will never get over. And it's going to continue to mutate until you get to the Zulu variant. And I fear that at that point, you know, vaccinations won't help. And I'm afraid of that. And no one wants to wear a mask. No one. I don't think there's anyone who wants to walk around with a mask. So to me, I think that we should.
Johnny, thanks a lot for the call. So Johnny worried, Dr. Nuzzo, not just about the spread of the disease itself, but the more people who catch it, the more opportunities to come up with new and potentially more quick spreading and dangerous variants.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That is the real concern, though. The pathway out of that is vaccination. Masks help buy us time. But really, to make sure that doesn't happen, we need to vaccinate people. So absolutely. And certainly, you know, I think there's a number of reasons why you're seeing school districts requiring masks for exactly the reason that the caller mentioned. But when I raise the question of whether mask mandates are required, certainly I think in certain environments like schools, it makes a lot of sense. But, you know, whether you need to say everyone in all public, indoor environments needs to wear a mask or not. There's clearly no downside to having to wear a mask unless you don't like to wear a mask, other than potentially, discouraging unvaccinated people from going out and getting the vaccine. But the condition that I'm actually worried about is that earlier in the pandemic, there were signals that certain environments may be driving transmission of the virus. Things like gathering with family members, social events inside of people's homes, going to bars and restaurants. Those are actually places that are not likely to be touched by mask mandates. And if those are the places that are still driving transmission, and again, this is why we need contact tracing data, which health departments should make public. If those are the places, then I just worry that the surge of cases that we're seeing may not be slowed enough by just telling everybody to wear a mask when they go to the grocery store.
Talking to Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo from the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security about masks and mask mandates. Back to your calls now with Tom in Stevens Point. Tom, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Tom?
I used to work in general surgery, and we used to use N95 masks when it was appropriate, but we always changed masks between patients, never ever reused a mask. The other point, and I don't want to be vulgar, but I want to point out two things. One, if you're wearing a mask and someone passes gas next to you and you can smell it, that means that is getting through your mask. And the virus is much smaller than passing gas. And so the current masks on the market don't work, and if you use an N95, you should be changing that every single day.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Nuzzo, as I understand it, we're not so much worried about can a virus pass through the mask, but can the water droplets that the virus is kind of hitchhiking on are getting in and out of the mask. Am I right about that?
Well, we're worried about both, but we're not necessarily worried about individual viral particles, but clumps of viruses, which, you know, are larger than just, you know, molecules of gas. But, you know, also, listen, no one intervention is perfect. We talk about them as being layered, and each layer adds a level of protection. The thickest layer of protection you can apply is a vaccine. Masks are another layer of protection. They work better the more people wear them. So not just the person wearing it to protect him or herself, but the person that they are going to be around, whose infection status is unknown. Hopefully it all adds up to a higher level. It certainly does add up to a higher level of protection.
Thanks for the call, Tom. In our last minute, Dr. Nuzzo, we've been talking about kind of more social approaches and mandates at city or state levels. Can you leave us with your thoughts for individuals as we see the Delta variant, as we see numbers go up? What advice do you have for people to stay safe and still enjoy life as much as they can while staying safe?
Yeah, well, first thing, have I said it enough? Please get vaccinated. If you are eligible, please, please, please get vaccinated. And if you are someone who's vaccinated, please talk to your loved ones, your friends, your neighbors. Talk to them. The data shows that people respond best to people that they know and trust, and not necessarily unnamed experts that they heard on the radio. So I hope that we can all have conversations with our loved ones. There's a lot of great resources out there to help bring some information to those conversations. But I can tell you, in the conversations that I've had, sometimes it's just important to hear people's fears about the vaccine. That is the first thing you can do. If you're in a situation where, you know, I think the people who probably feel the most anxious right now are people who have kids who are too young to be vaccinated. I'm in that boat. What I do with my kids is we try to stay outside as much as possible and try to find fun activities that are outdoors. When we do go to public spaces indoors, we all wear masks, my kids certainly, but the parents do, just to show solidarity with them as well. Hopefully we can take advantage of the summer and warmer months before it gets to be too cold to try to do as much socializing outdoors as possible.
Dr. Nuzzo, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. We talked to her today about specific factors that she says officials need to consider when issuing mask mandates. Coming up after the news, the author of the new book, We're Not Broken, shares stories of life with autism and says we need to change the conversation from fixes and cures to mutual understanding. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, the Biden administration and automakers are making a big push for electric vehicles, including charging stations and other key infrastructure. Find out what's in place now and what could change in the years to come. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, there's a lot of misinformation out there about autism, from myths about vaccines to misconceptions about who's affected by autism. Our next guest is a reporter who's on the autism spectrum himself. In his new book, he shares stories from people around the country and tackles some of those myths and misconceptions. And he says we need to rethink the autism conversation and move from talking about cures and treatments to finding better ways to include people at work, at school, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you autistic? Or is someone in your family, one of your loved ones, autistic? What do you think people get wrong about it? What are ways that society is not built for people with autism? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Eric Michael Garcia is a senior D.C. correspondent for The Independent. He's the author of the new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about what led you as a reporter, a journalist with autism, to tackle this book and talk to people around the country to share their stories?
Sure. So first off, I was born. I was born autistic. That's an old joke for you. The second thing that happened was that I moved to Washington, D.C. when I was 23. I moved to be an economics and politics journalist. I always wanted to be that. Didn't think I'd ever be anything more than that. Then I was at a party one night with a friend by the name of Tim Mack. And he offered me a drink. And I said, oh, I don't drink because I'm on the autism spectrum. And I don't. And a medicine I take doesn't mix with alcohol. And he's like, oh, there's a lot of autistic people in Washington, D.C. in politics, in law, in journalism, and things like that. He's like, you should write something about that. And I thought, okay, you know, maybe one day. But then when I was at National Journal and then they were shutting down the print magazine, I pitched that article to my editor. And he's like, well, why should this exist? And he's like, well, I said, well, I think we focus too much on trying to cure autistic people, not enough on trying to help them live fulfilling lives. He's like, there's your piece right there. And then, so I wrote that piece. That broke big. And then my next question was, well, what would that look like? And you have to remember, around this time in 2015, I grew up in Southern California. There was a big measles outbreak at Disneyland, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, those are a bunch of hippies in California. And at the same time, Donald Trump was running for president, and he was saying that autism has become an epidemic. He blamed vaccines, just saying a lot of things that were just not true. So my feeling was, somewhere along the line, we've gotten a lot wrong about autism. And as a political journalist, my feeling is, okay, if we're getting things wrong about autism, that must mean that what we do to help, quote unquote, help autistic people must be really bad too. So I hit the road, and I'm a political journalist at heart. So I decided to hit the road and see, how are we failing autistic people? But more importantly, what could be done to make things better for autistic people?
And a recurring theme in your book, I mean, it's in the title, you just mentioned it all throughout the book, this idea that we're not broken, you're not broken, and moving the conversation from how do we prevent autism, cure autism, fix autism, whatever, to how do we change society so that we include people with different neurodiversity, I think is the phrase often used.
Different who are neurodivergent, you know. So the stat I always give is that of the $364 million the United States spends, both with nonprofits and with the federal government, spends on autism research, and this is from 2016, only about 2% of that goes toward lifespan issues. By comparison, about 35% of autism spending research goes on biology, and about 24% goes on risk factors. So that's about half of our research budget goes to what causes autism, and then, you know, what are risk factors. And then on top of that, there are treatments. So that's a large part of it. And then we're not really spending that much on what happens to autistic people as they grow up. What are the difficulties that they face? What are the difficulties as they want to go to school, or if they can't go to school, or if they can work, or if they can't work? What's the problems facing unemployment? So to me, that seemed like a big problem, because it seemed like for a long time we were focusing on what parents or what researchers or what clinicians or professors wanted, and less on what can we actually do for the people right here and right now. You know, even if you were to create a cure, that's not going to help autistic people who you have right now.
One other misconception you look at is who people think of as autistic. And I think the image that I'll admit usually would pop into my mind, and I think for a lot of people, is they're young, they're white, and they're male. And that is not accurate at all, right?
Right. I mean, like the classic example is, if you look at shows like The Good Doctor, or what's the other one? Atypical, or even going back to shows like or movies like Rain Man, the archetype of an autistic person is typically a young, typically adolescent or teenage white male, sometimes older. And if you look at covers like Time and Newsweek, I went back and I looked at a lot of covers of Time magazine, and it was like young, you know, blonde haired adolescent boys. But like, A, that excludes a lot of adults. B, that excludes a lot of women and girls. And C, that really excludes a lot of people of color. And it goes back to my point that in the original study about autism in 1943, the first widely read study about autism in 1943, Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact by Leo Connor. None of the children were people of color. Only three of them were girls. Nine of them were from Anglo-Saxon families, and the other two were Jewish. And as a result, we kind of still have that idea of those are the type of people who can be autistic.
We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia about his new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. A quote, Eric, that struck me in your book is from John Elder Robison, an autistic author and advocate. I'm quoting him now, as you quoted in your book. Our duty in autism is not to cure, but to relieve suffering and to maximize each person's potential. Can you talk about that mindset as a starting point?
Certainly. I think that a lot of people say that we talk about not curing autism. We're saying that autism is all rainbows and butterflies, or it's not a disability. Autism is a disability. I will say that from the rooftops. But what we should do is we should work to fix the impairments, or work to help autistic people with the impairments, with their impairments. And then we should also work to maximize their potential. And just like how you don't want to, how deaf people don't want to be cured or blind people don't want to be cured, we should, or we wouldn't want to cure people with Down syndrome, we should work to improve the lives of autistic people, get rid of the impairments, but then also find ways to make the world more adaptable to them and find ways to make the world better for them. So if, you know, so a statistic that I cite, and we don't even really know, is that autistic people, around 85% of autistic young adults we know, deal with unemployment. That's a big social problem. We should look at what does it take to help autistic people find work and make sure that they have good jobs if they want to work or if they can work. What does it take, and how can we facilitate that more than just, oh, we should try to fix them, you know?
You give an example from your own career, your academic career at community college, then at the University of North Carolina, about accommodations for you that you were initially reluctant to ask about.
So, I mean, I think that a lot of autistic people and a lot of disabled people as a whole, especially when you go to university, you've already gone through a special education system at one point or another, and you've seen how often it usually doesn't help, or it's segregating and it's isolating, or you get treated, or you know, because kids can be so cruel, they see that it puts a mark on your back, or there's a lot of other things. So a lot of times we just don't want to talk about it. And then also we're afraid that we're going to be seen as getting special treatment. It's why I'm not a fan of the term special needs. But those accommodations are there, and they're there for a reason, and they matter. And I think that a lot of times we have to overcome our ableism, our internalized ableism, and the thoughts that, you know, we're told from the beginning of our lives that we're a problem. And we need to recognize that those services are there for a reason. And I think on top of that, we're also kind of told that, well, if you're at university, you must not be really disabled, right? Which is like such a terrible thing to say, because it says that only certain types of people can go to university. It says that you can't go to university if you're disabled. What we should do is we should say that, you know, you're here for a reason. These accommodations are here to help you, and we should not fear them, you know?
We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia, senior DC correspondent for The Independent. He's talking to us about his new book. It's called We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have experience with autism yourself? If you're willing to share the story of when you first found out about a diagnosis, maybe it's somebody in your family. Or do you have a question for our guest about the conversations he had with people around the country, the different accommodations he found out about along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Eric Michael Garcia about his new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in 800-642-1234. with your experiences, maybe with autism yourself or with a loved one, or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Eric, as part of your work on this book, you talked to people who need more care in their everyday lives, who, for example, maybe university may not be an option, who had experiences different than your own. What kind of things did you learn from them?
Yeah, they were, it was really important for me to include autistic people who have higher support needs or maybe who can't speak. And it was important for me to say that because, or maybe university might not be an option for them. And it was important for me because I wanted to show that they could have a good life and that it's possible to have a good life. Because I think a lot of times people say, and I knew the response to this book would be, oh, it's easy for you to say because you are quote unquote high functioning, even though I'm not a fan of that term, and you are successful, you have a job, things like that. But what about my kid? So I wanted to include people who are, A, I believe that I have a lot more in common with your kid than you realized. B, I wanted to include people like these kids and like your child. And I wanted to show that it was possible to live a good and happy life. And the way we do that is by having a support system around you, a support system around these people, and B, that we that it requires spending and it requires prioritization of these things. And it requires that we prioritize ensuring that these people have home and community-based services that they so that they can live in the community, that these are actual home and community-based services, that they're not just de facto institutions like they often have been. Or we wanted to, you know, I wanted to show that it's possible for them that they should have, you know, home care workers who care about them and take them seriously and take their medical needs seriously. I wanted to make sure that if they have intellectual disabilities, they aren't exploited in workshops, segregated workshops, or paid below the minimum wage, which is completely legal, and people don't realize that. So it was really important for me to include their voices as well.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Kathy, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking this call. My question is regarding, first of all, Eric, you're a brilliant guy, and kudos to you for doing what you do. I have met a young man who's 24 years old. He's very affected by autism. He is not able to live by himself. He goes to a day program. But he says to me, I am not autistic. I have autism. And I'm wondering, I hear you referring to autistic people, and I'm wondering which you prefer.
Kathy, thanks for the call.
So,
yeah, go ahead, Eric.
That is a good question. That is a really good question. The thing that I did when I was traveling around, I made sure to ask, was I was really keen to ask people, do you prefer to use what's called person first language or identity first language? Person first language is, I believe, what this gentleman is referring to himself as. I have autism, and then I tend to say that I'm autistic. And it's everybody's personal preference, and I'm not going to tell anybody how to refer to themselves. But B, I think the change comes because for a long time, parents of autistic people wanted to make sure that their children weren't defined by their disability, or they were afraid that if they were called autistic, that it would lead to stigma. I think a younger generation, even though this young man I think is younger than I am, he's 24 and I'm 30 years old, a lot of younger autistic people, and I guess people who have understood themselves more, see that autism is inextricable from who they are. That a lot of people say, see the person, not the disability, or don't let your disability define you. No, like, I really need you to see my disability, and I need you to see other autistic people's disability, and I need you to see that, A, that doesn't make them less, but B, that it is an intrinsic part to who they are. So I think that there's a divide, but again, I think that it really depends on how that person sees themselves. And again, I wouldn't tell this young man how to I'm feeling old now, but I wouldn't tell this young man how to see himself. But I would, but more than anything, I'm curious why he sees that as important. To, why it's why that distinction is important, because it's a distinction we all take and we all carry with each other. So,
thanks a lot for the call and the question, Kathy, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia. His new book is "We're Not Broken: Changing the Autism Conversation." Let's go back to your calls now. Michelle is with us in Kenosha. Michelle, hi.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Love this conversation. I have an uncle who was born in 1935 and wasn't diagnosed with autism till about 10 years ago.
Okay.
So, one, what I find interesting is, you know, that's just who he was. So our family had to deal with that. But he did have a successful life as a cabinet refinisher. He's extremely good with wood. But one thing I picked up on that you were talking about is how to deal with how to address needs as people get older, because now that he's in his 80s, it's been a challenge because he feels pain differently. And so my cousins and I have to work with the medical professionals so that they understand, like, if he starts doing this grunting or screaming, he's in pain, but he doesn't know how to communicate that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it has been important for us to be translators for him. And it's interesting because, you know, on his own, it's like nobody listens. But if we help translate, then all of a sudden the doctor's like, oh, that's right. And then he gets treated and it solves the problem.
Michelle, thanks for that call. Eric, go for it.
That is really good. First off, that reminds me a lot of this woman and her mother I profiled in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, by the name of Lil Wayman and her mother, Brookie. That, like, a lot of people didn't take Lydia seriously, but they took her mom seriously, so that when they go to the hospital, like, her mom goes with her. And that was really important because, like, she recognized that, like, and in some ways she could be an advocate for her. And then, now Lydia can speak, so, you know, it's not, you know, she's not taken as unseriously as other people, even though there, I have some stories about, like, how people didn't think that she thought she was faking. But, like, that's really good that you recognize that him grunting or his screaming or things like that are him trying to communicate something. Because I think a lot of times when we focus on is that when people see that see autistic people screaming or see them, you know, grunting or even hurting themselves, a lot of times we focus on the behavior, but we don't focus on what actually is causing it. So A, that's really good. But B, you know, to my point, that's really why I wanted to write this book, because we really don't know a lot of things. I can't really, as much as I would like to give you a good answer, I don't think I could give you a good one, because we have, again, we only spend about 2%. In 2016, we only spent about 2% of all of our entire research budget looking at lifespan issues. And that's really tragic, because autism, and I think about it too, because eventually I'm going to get old. I'm going to be like, you know, your uncle. And I don't know what's going to happen. And that's a really tough question. I don't really know. I wish I had a better answer, but I don't. I'm sorry.
Thanks for that call. And Eric, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Eric Michael Garcia. He's a senior DC correspondent for The Independent, longtime political correspondent. He joined us for a look at his book today. It's called We're Not Broken: Changing the Autism Conversation. If you have a story to share with us, there's still time. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, job numbers are bouncing back up around the country and here in Wisconsin. Some businesses are having trouble finding workers. We'll get the latest on concerns about a labor shortage, at least in some industries, and find out what it means for employers and job seekers and whether policy changes are needed to help tackle it. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with an old standby that apparently, I am told, is turning into a big trend these days. It's canned seafood. People getting tins of sardines, canned tuna, canned salmon, and more, and working into some fancy recipes. I see visible reaction from our technical director. She's not in on the trend, but maybe you are. Let us know. Email now, ideas@WPR.org, with your favorite recipe that includes canned seafood. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Yesterday on the show, we talked about the movies that make us cry. And a lot of you called in to share your personal weepies, and more of you emailed or shared yours on Facebook. Here are some of them. Cody says the end of Saving Private Ryan. Cody says that's a guy's weepy. Jane says Old Yeller. Yeah, it's a classic. And Out of Africa. He recommends the Terms of Endearment. Yeah, that's, I feel like that's one of those that was made to make people cry. Kristen says The Notebook. Tim recommends Peter Weir's Fearless. I don't think I know that one. Eric recommends It's a Wonderful Life. I can totally see that. Jocelyn says the movie Dark Victory. Don't know that one. Rebecca tells us two animated films really got to me. Last year's movie Soul surprised me by drawing out tears a few times during the movie. And Coco from a couple years ago. If you want to cry, Rebecca says, watch Coco. Lucia goes with 50 First Dates, The Descendants, and Calendar Girls. Brandy says, yeah, we've heard this a lot. The beginning montage in Up got me. Christine says, Beaches. That's, I think, feel like that's also like in that Terms of Endearment category. And Deborah says, so many movies make me cry. Sometimes I embrace it and feel a catharsis. Other times I'm furious with Hollywood and their power to manipulate me. But it's Field of Dreams that leaps to mind in this discussion. My father grew up the son of an Iowa farmer all the way through his life. One of his dearest loves was the Chicago White Sox. It's a very personal emotion that movie reaches. Is this heaven? No, it's Iowa. Keep sharing yours on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.